From Elmhurst Public Library, this is Storytime for Grown-Ups. I am Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to Episode 8. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains, expands our imaginations, and is just plain fun. Today we'll hear two stories by award-winning and prolific author Ray Bradbury. Although well-known for his book Fahrenheit 451, Bradbury was also active in film, TV, and the development of the 1964 New York World's Fair and Disney's Epcot Center. His stories always provoke thought, definitely tip toward the macabre, and some even take place in our home state. Bradbury was from Illinois. See if you recognize the setting in one of this episode's tales. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
The Lake by Ray Bradbury. The waves shut me off from the world, from the birds in the sky, the children on the beach, my mother on the shore. There was a moment of green silence. Then the wave gave me back to the sky, the sand, the children yelling. I came out of the lake and the world was waiting for me, having hardly moved since I went away. I ran up on the beach. Mama swabbed me with a furry towel. "Stand there and dry," she said. I stood there, watching the sun take away the water beads on my arms. I replaced them with goose pimples. "My, there's a wind," said Mama. "Put on your sweater." "Wait till I watch my goosebumps," I said. "Harold," said Mama. I put the sweater on and watched the waves come up and fall down on the beach, but not clumsily, on purpose, with a green sort of elegance. Even a drunken man could not collapse with such elegance as those waves. It was September, in the last days when things are getting sad for no reason. The beach was so long and lonely, with only about 6 people on it. The kids quit bouncing the ball because somehow the wind made them sad too, whistling the way it did. And the kids sat down and felt autumn come along the endless shore. All of the hot dog stands were boarded up with strips of golden planking, sealing in all the mustard, onion, meat odors of the long, joyful summer. It was like nailing summer into a series of coffins. One by one, the places slammed their covers down, padlocked their doors, and the wind came and touched the sand, blowing away all of the million footprints of July and August. It got so that now, in September, there was nothing but the mark of my rubber tennis shoes and Donald and Dallas Arnold's feet down by the water curve. Sand blew up in curtains on the sidewalks, and the merry-go-round was hidden with canvas, all the horses frozen in midair on their brass poles, showing teeth, galloping on, with only the wind for music slipping through canvas. I stood there. Everyone else was in school. I was not. Tomorrow I would be on my way west across the United States on a train. Mom and I had come to the beach for one last brief moment. There was something about the loneliness that made me want to get away by myself. "Mama, I want to run up the beach a ways," I said. "All right, but hurry back and don't go near the water." I ran. Sand spun under me and the wind lifted me. You know how it is, running, arms out so you feel veils from your fingers, caused by the wind, like wings. Mama withdrew into the distance, sitting. Soon she was only a brown speck and I was all alone. Being alone is a newness to a 12-year-old child. He is so used to people about. The only way he can be alone is in his mind. There are so many real people around, telling children what and how to do, that a boy has to run off down a beach, even if it's only in his head, to get by himself in his own world. So now I was really alone. I went down to the water and let it cool up to my stomach. Always before, with the crowd, I hadn't dared to look, to come to this spot and search around in the water and call a certain name. But now, water is like a magician, sawing you in half. It feels as if you were cut in two, part of you, the lower part sugar melting, dissolving away. cool water, and once in a while a very elegantly stumbling wave that fell with a flourish of lace. I called her name. A dozen times I called it. Tally! Tally! Oh, Tally! You really expect answers to your calling when you are young. You feel that whatever you may think can be real, and sometimes maybe that is not so wrong. I thought of Tally swimming out into the water last May, with her pigtails trailing, blonde. She went laughing and the sun was on her small 12-year-old shoulders. I thought of the water settling quiet, of the lifeguard leaping into it, of Tally's mother screaming, and of how Tally never came out. The lifeguard tried to persuade her to come out, but she did not. He came back with only bits of waterweed in his big knuckled fingers, and Tally was gone. She would not sit across from me at school any longer, or chase indoor balls on the brick streets on summer nights. She had gone too far out, and the lake would not let her return. And now, in the lonely autumn when the sky was huge and the water was huge, and the beach was so very long, I had come down for the last time, alone. I called her name again and again. Tally! Oh, Tally! The wind blew so very softly over my ears, the way wind blows over the mouths of seashells to set them whispering. The water rose, embraced my chest, then my knees, up and down, one way and another, sucking under my heels. Tally! Come back! Tally! I was only 12, but I know how much I loved her. It was that love that comes before all significance of body and morals. It was that love that is no more bad than wind and sea and sand, lying side by side forever. It was made of all the warm, long days together at the beach, and the humming, quiet days of droning education at the school. All the long autumn days of the years past when I had carried her books home from school. Tally! I called her name for the last time. I shivered. I felt water on my face and did not know how it got there. The waves had not splashed that high. Turning, I retreated to the sand and stood there for half an hour, hoping for one glimpse, one sign, one little bit of Tally to remember. Then I knelt and built a sandcastle, shaping it fine, building as Tally and I had built so many of them. But this time, I only built half of it. Then I got up. Tally, if you hear me, come in and build the rest. I walked off toward that faraway speck that was Mama. The water came in, blended the sandcastle circle by circle, mashing it down little by little into the original smoothness. Silently, I walked along the shore. Far away, a merry-go-round jangled faintly, but it was only the wind. The next day, I went away on the train. A train has a poor memory. It soon puts all behind it. It forgets the cornlands of Illinois, the rivers of childhood, the bridges, the lakes, the valleys, the cottages, the hurts and the joys. It spreads them out behind, and they drop back of the horizon. I lengthened my bones, put flesh on them, changed my young mind for an older one, threw away clothes as they no longer fitted, shifted from grammar to high school to college, and then there was a young woman in Sacramento. I knew her for a time, and we were married. By the time I was 22, I had almost forgotten what the East was like. Margaret suggested that our delayed honeymoon be taken back in that direction. Like a memory, a train works both ways. A train can bring rushing back all those things you left behind so many years before. Lake Bluff, population 10,000, came up over the sky. Margaret looked so handsome in her fine new clothes. She watched me as I felt my old world gather me back into its living. She held my arm as the train slid into Bluff Station, and our baggage was escorted out. So many years, and the things they do to people's faces and bodies. When we walked through the town together, I saw no one I recognized. There were faces with echoes in them, echoes of hikes on ravine trails, faces with small laughter in them from closed grammar schools, and swinging on metal-linked swings, and going up and down on teeter-totters. But I didn't speak. I walked and looked and filled up inside with all those memories, like leaves stacked for autumn burning. We stayed on 2 weeks in all, revisiting all the places together. The days were happy. I thought I loved Margaret well. At least I thought I did. It was on one of the last days that we walked down by the shore. It was not quite as late in the year as that day so many years before, but the first evidence of desertion were coming up the beach. People were thinning out. Several of the hot dog stands had been shuttered and nailed, and the wind, as always, waited there to sing for us. I almost saw Mama sitting on the sand as she used to sit. I had that feeling again of wanting to be alone. But I could not force myself to speak of this to Margaret. I only held on to her and waited. It got late in the day. Most of the children had gone home, and only a few men and women remained basking in the windy sun. The lifeguard boat pulled up on the shore. The lifeguard stepped out of it slowly, with something in his arms. I froze there. I held my breath, and I felt small, only 12 years old, very little, very infinitesimal and afraid. The wind howled. I could not see Margaret. I could see only the beach, the lifeguard slowly emerging from the boat with a gray sack in his hands, not very heavy, and his face almost as gray and lined. "Stay here, Margaret," I said. I don't know why I said it. "But why?" "Just stay here, that's all." I walked slowly down the sand to where the lifeguard stood. He looked at me. "What is it?" I asked. The lifeguard kept looking at me for a long time, and he couldn't speak. He put the gray sack on the sand, and water whispered wet up around it, and went back. "What is it?" I insisted. "Strange," said the lifeguard quietly. I waited. "Strange," he said softly. "Strangest thing I ever saw. She's been dead a long time." I repeated his words. He nodded. 10 years, I'd say. There haven't been any children drowned here this year. There were 12 children drowned here since 1933, but we found all of them before a few hours had passed. All except one, I remember. This body here, why, it must be 10 years in the water. It's not pleasant." I stared at the gray sack in his arms. "Open it," I said. I don't know why I said it. The wind was louder. He fumbled with the sack. "Hurry, man, open it," I cried.
I better not do that," he said.
Then perhaps he saw the way my face must have looked.
"She was such a little girl."
He opened it only part way. That was enough. The beach was deserted. There was only the sky and the wind and the water and the autumn coming on lonely. I looked down at her there. I said something over and over. A name. The lifeguard looked at me. "Where did you find her?" I asked.
"Down the beach, that way, in the shallow water. It's a long, long time for her, isn't it?"
I shook my head. "Yes, it is. Oh, God, yes, it is." I thought, people grow. I have grown, but she has not changed. She is still small. She is still young. Death does not permit growth or change. She still has golden hair. She will be forever young, and I will love her forever. Oh, God, I will love her forever. The lifeguard tied up the sack again. Down the beach, a few moments later, I walked by myself. I stopped and looked down at something. "This is where the lifeguard found her," I said to myself. There at the water's edge lay a sandcastle, only half built.
just like Tally and I used to build them. She half and I half. I looked at it. I knelt beside the sandcastle and saw the small prints of feet coming in from the lake and going back out to the lake again and not returning. Then I knew. "I'll help you finish it," I said. I did. I built the rest of it up very slowly. Then I arose and turned away and walked off, so as not to watch it crumble in the waves, as all things crumble. I walked back up the beach where a strange woman named Margaret was waiting for me, smiling.
The Emissary by Ray Bradbury. Martin knew it was autumn again, for Dog ran into the house bringing wind and frost, and a smell of apples turned to cider under trees. In dark clock springs of hair, Dog fetched goldenrod, dust of farewell summer, acorn husk, hair of squirrel, feather of departed robin, sawdust from fresh-cut cordwood, and leaves like charcoal shaken from a blaze of maple trees. Dog jumped. Showers of brittle fern, blackberry vine, marsh grass sprang over the bed where Martin shouted. No doubt, no doubt of it at all. This incredible beast was October. "Here, boy, here!" And Dog settled to warm Martin's body with all the bonfires and subtle burnings of the season, to fill the room with soft or heavy, wet or dry odors of far traveling. In spring, he smelled of lilac, iris, lawn-mowered grass. In summer, ice cream mustached, he came pungent with firecracker, Roman candle, pinwheel, baked by the sun. But autumn, "Dog, what's it like outside?" And lying there, Dog told as he always told. Lying there, Martin found autumn as in the old days before sickness bleached him white on his bed. Here was his contact, his carry-all, the quick-moving part of himself he sent with a yell to run and return, circle and scent, collect and deliver the time and texture of worlds and town, country, by creek, river, lake, down cellar, up attic, in closet or coal bin. 10 dozen times a day he was gifted with sunflower seed, cinder path, milkweed, horse chestnut, or full flame smell of pumpkin. Through the loomings of the universe, Dog shuttled. The design was hid in his pelt. "Put out your hand." It was there. "And where did you go this morning?" But he knew without hearing where Dog had rattled down hills, where autumn lay in cereal Christmas, where children lay in funeral pyres, in rustling heaps, the leaf buried but watchful dead, as Dog in the world blew by. Martin trembled his fingers, searched the thick fur, read the long journey, through stubbled fields, over glitters of ravine creek, down marbled spread of cemetery yard, into woods. In the great season of spices and rare incense, now Martin ran through his emissary, around, about, and home. The bedroom door opened. "That dog of yours is in trouble again." Mother brought in a tray of fruit salad, cocoa, and toast, her blue eyes snapping. "Mother, always digging places. Dug a hole in Miss Tarkin's garden this morning. She's spitting mad. That's the fourth hole he's dug there this week. Maybe he's looking for something." "Fiddlesticks, he's too darn curious. If he doesn't behave, he'll be locked up." Martin looked at this woman as if she were a stranger. "Oh, you wouldn't do that. How would I learn anything? How would I find things out if Dog didn't tell me?" Mom's voice was quieter. "Is that what he does? Tell you things?" "There's nothing I don't know when he goes out and around and back. Nothing I can't find out from him." They both sat looking at Dog and the dry stewings of mold and seed over the quilt. "Well, if he'll just stop digging where he shouldn't, he can run all he wants," said Mother. "Here, boy, here." And Martin snapped a tin note to the dog's collar. "My owner is Martin Smith, 10 years old. Sick in bed. Visitors welcome." Dog barked, Mother opened the downstairs door and let him out. Martin sat listening. Far off and away, you could hear Dog run in the quiet autumn rain that was falling now. You could hear the barking, jingling fade, rise, fade again as he cut down alley, over lawn, to fetch back Mr. Holloway and the oiled metallic smell of the delicate, snowflake-interiored watches he repaired in his home shop. Or maybe he would bring Mr. Jacobs, the grocer, whose clothes were rich with lettuce, celery, tomatoes, and the secret tinned and hidden smell of the red demon stamped on cans of deviled ham. Mr. Jacobs and his unseen pink meat devils waved often from the yard below. Or Dog brought Mr. Jackson, Mrs. Gillespie, Mr. Smith, Mrs. Holmes, any friend or near friend, encountered, cornered, begged, worried, and at last shepherded home for lunch or tea and biscuits. Now, listening, Martin heard Dog below, with footsteps moving in the light rain behind him. The downstairs bell rang. Mom opened the door. Light voices murmured. Martin sat forward, face shining. The stair treads creaked. A young woman's voice laughed quietly. Miss Haight, of course, his teacher from school. The bedroom door sprang open. Martin had company. Morning, afternoon, evening, dawn and dusk, sun and moon circled with Dog, who faithfully reported temperatures of turf and air, color of earth and tree, consistency of mist or rain, but, most important of all, brought back again and again and again Miss Haight. On Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, she baked Martin orange iced cupcakes, brought him library books about dinosaurs and cavemen. On Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, somehow he beat her at dominoes. Somehow she lost at checkers. And soon, she cried, he'd defeat her handsomely at chess. On Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they talked and never stopped talking. And she was so young and laughing and handsome, and her hair was a soft, shining brown like the season outside the window. And she walked clear, clean, and quick, a heartbeat warm in the bitter afternoon when he heard it. Above all, she had the secret of signs and could read and interpret Dog and the symbols she searched out and plucked forth from his coat with her miraculous fingers. Eyes shut, softly laughing in a gypsy's voice, she divined the world from the treasures in her hands. And on Monday afternoon, Miss Haight was dead. Martin sat up in bed slowly. Dead? He whispered. Dead, said his mother. Yes, dead. Killed in an auto accident a mile out of town. Dead, yes. Dead. Which meant cold to Martin, which meant silence and whiteness and winter come long before its time. Dead, silent, cold, white. The thoughts circled round, blew down, and settled in whispers. Martin held Dog, thinking, turned to the wall. The lady with the autumn-colored hair, the lady with the laughter that was very gentle and never made fun, and the eyes that watched your mouth to see everything you ever said. The other half of Autumn Lady, who told what was left untold by Dog about the world. The heartbeat at the still center of gray afternoon. The heartbeat fading. Mom, what do they do in the graveyard? Mom, under the ground, just lay there?
Lie there.
Lie there. Is that all they do? It doesn't sound like much fun.
For goodness sake, it's not made out to be fun.
Why don't they just jump up and run around once in a while? If they get tired lying there. I mean, God's pretty silly.
Martin.
Well, you'd think he'd treat people better than to tell them to lie still for keeps. That's impossible. Nobody can do it. I tried once. Dog tries. I tell him, dead dog. He plays dead a while, then gets sick and tired and wags his tail or opens one eye and looks at me, bored. Boy,
I bet sometimes those graveyard people do the same, huh? Dog?
Dog barked. Be still with that kind of talk, said Mother. Martin looked off into space.
Bet that's exactly what they do, he said.
Autumn burnt the trees bare and ran Dog still farther around, fording creek, prowling graveyard as was his custom, and back in the dusk to fire off volleys of barking that shook windows wherever he turned. In the late last days of October, Dog began to act as if the wind had changed and blew from a strange country. He stood quivering on the porch below. He whined, his eyes fixed at the empty land beyond town. He brought no visitors for Martin. He stood for hours each day, as if leashed, trembling, then shot away straight, as if someone had called. Each night he returned later, with no one following. Each night, Martin sank deeper and deeper in his pillow.
Well, people are busy, said Mother. They haven't time to notice the tag Dog carries. Or they mean to come visit, but forget.
But there was more to it than that. There was the fevered shining in Dog's eyes, and his whimpering tick late at night in some private dream. His shivering in the dark under the bed. The way he sometimes stood half the night, looking at Martin as if some great and impossible secret was his, and he knew no way to tell it save by savagely thumping his tail, or turning in endless circles, never to lie down, spinning and spinning again. On October 30th, Dog ran out and didn't come back at all, even when after supper Martin heard his parents call and call. The hour grew late. The streets and sidewalks stood empty. The air moved cold about the house, and there was nothing. Nothing. Long after midnight, Martin lay watching the world beyond the cool, clear glass windows. Now there was not even autumn, for there was no Dog to fetch it in. There would be no winter, for who could bring the snow to melt in your hands? Father? Mother? No, not the same. They couldn't play the game with its special secrets and rules, its sounds and pantomimes. No more seasons. No more time. The go-between, the emissary, was lost to the wild throngings of civilization. Poisoned, stolen, hit by a car, left somewhere in a culvert. Sobbing, Martin turned his face to his pillow. The world was a picture under glass, untouchable. The world was dead. Martin twisted in bed, and in 3 days, the last Halloween pumpkins were riding in trash cans. Papier-mâché skulls and witches were burnt on bonfires, and ghosts were stacked on shelves with other linens until next year. To Martin, Halloween had been nothing more than one evening when tin horns cried off in the cold autumn stars. Children blew like goblin leaves along the flinty walks, flinging their heads or cabbages at porches, soap-writing names or similar magic symbols on icy windows. All of it as distant, unfathomable, and nightmarish as a puppet show seen from so many miles away that there is no sound or meaning. For 3 days in November, Martin watched alternate light and shadow sift across his ceiling. The fire pageant was over forever. Autumn lay in cold ashes. Martin sank deeper, yet deeper, in white marble layers of bed, motionless, listening, always listening. Friday evening, his parents kissed him goodnight and walked out of the house into the hushed cathedral weather toward a motion picture show. Miss Tarkins from next door stayed on in the parlor below, until Martin called down he was sleepy, then took her knitting off home. In silence, Martin lay following the great move of stars down a clear and moonlit sky, remembering nights such as this when he had spanned the town with Dog ahead, behind, around about, tracking the green plush ravine, lapping slumberous streams gone milky with the fullness of the moon,
leaping cemetery tombstones while whispering the marble names. On, quickly on, through shaved meadows where the only motion was the off-on quivering of stars. To streets where shadows would not stand aside for you, but crowded all the sidewalks for mile on mile. Run, now run, chasing, being chased by bitter smoke, fog, mist, wind, ghost of mine, fright of memory, home, safe, sound, snug, warm, asleep. 9 o'clock, chime, the drowsy clock in the deep stairwell below, chime, dog, come home and run the world with you, dog, bring a thistle with frost on it, or bring nothing else but the wind. Dog, where are you? Oh, listen now. I'll call. Martin held his breath. Way off somewhere, a sound. Martin rose, trembling. There again, the sound. So small a sound. Like a sharp needle point brushing the sky long miles and many miles away. The dreamy echo of a dog barking. The sound of a dog crossing fields and farms, dirt roads and rabbit paths, running, running, letting out great barks of steam, cracking the night. The sound of a circling dog which came and went. Lifted and faded, opened up, shut in, moved forward, went back, as if the animal were kept by someone on a fantastically long chain. As if the dog were running and someone whistled under the chestnut trees, in mold shadow, tar shadow, moon shadow, walking, and the dog circled back and sprang out again toward home. Dog, Martin thought. Oh, dog, come home, boy. Listen, oh, listen, where have you been? Come on, boy, make tracks. 5, 10, 15 minutes, near, very near. The bark, the sound. Martin cried out, thrust his feet from the bed, leaned to the window. Dog, listen, boy, dog, dog, he said it over and over. Dog, dog, wicked dog, run off and gone all these days. Bad dog, good dog, home. Boy, hurry and bring what you can. Near now, near, up the street, barking, to knock clabbered house fronts with sound, whirl iron cocks on rooftops in the moon, firing off volleys. Dog, now at the door below. Martin shivered. Should he run? Let dog in, or wait for mom and dad. Wait. Oh, God, wait. But what if dog ran off again? No, he'd go down, snatch the door wide, yell, grab dog in, and run upstairs so fast, laughing, crying, holding tight that... Dog stopped barking. Hey! Martin always broke the window, jerking to it. Silence. As if someone had told dog to hush now. Hush. Hush. A full minute passed. Martin clenched his fist. Below, a faint whimpering. Then slowly the downstairs front door opened. Someone was kind enough to have opened the door for dog. Of course! Dog had brought Mr. Jacobs, or Mr. Gillespie, or Miss Tarkins, or... The downstairs door shut. Dog raced upstairs, whining. Flung himself on the bed. Dog, dog, where have you been? What have you done? Dog, dog. And he crushed dog hard and long to himself, weeping. Dog, dog. He laughed and shouted, dog. But after a moment, he stopped laughing and crying. Suddenly, he pulled back away. He held the animal and looked at him, eyes widening. The odor coming from dog was different. It was a smell of strange earth. It was a smell of night within night. The smell of digging down deep in shadow through earth that had lain cheek by jowl with things that were long hidden and decayed. A stinking and rancid soil fell away in clods of dissolution from dog's muzzle and paws. He had dug deep. He had dug very deep indeed. That was it, wasn't it? Wasn't it? Wasn't it? What kind of message was this from dog? What could such a message mean? The stench, the ripe and awful cemetery earth. Dog was a bad dog, digging where he shouldn't. Dog was a good dog, always making friends. Dog loved people. Dog brought them home. And now, moving up the dark hall stairs at intervals, came the sound of feet. One foot dragged after the other, painfully, slowly, slowly, slowly. Dog shivered. A rain of strange night earth fell seething on the bed. Dog turned. The bedroom door whispered in. Martin had company.
Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Our director and editor is Josh Jers, our producer and host is Margie Kohlwacher, and our stories today were narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.